Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode. And this isn't just any old episode of Wax Ecstatic. And this isn't just any random pull. The card we are discussing, one of my favorites for a number of reasons, from 1980 Tops. Card number 77, Dave Steeb, arguably one of the greatest pitchers. Well, I don't think it's arguably. He is one of the greatest pitchers of Toronto Blue Jays history. You can argue, is he the greatest? I mean, you had Roy Halladay. You had, Roger Clemens, briefly. You had a couple others. Pat Henkin, you could make somewhat of a case. But especially when it comes to the 1980s, it was all Dave Steeb all the time. And this was not a random pull. No, this one I purposely dug through the collection and found, because this is the last episode of Wax Ecstatic. I'll let that sink in for a second. Okay, I know there's going to be plenty of wailing and gnashing of teeth, and that's okay. But before we talk about Dave Steeb, before we talk about 1980 Tops, allow me to explain a few reasons why I've decided to do this. And one is simply time. It's something, this is a labor of love. I've said that before. That's why I've said, I don't make money off of this or don't charge a subscription fee for the podcast. But it's one of those things that it does take 2 to 3 hours to record and produce and do a little research on, especially players that I need to refamiliarize myself with. Dave Steeb was one of my favorite Blue Jays. So I'm just kind of talking off the cuff with my presentation of his story. But it takes time, and time has been slowly slipping away in the sense of free time. Just very busy with work, with my family, and with, me time too. You have to have a little bit of that time to yourself to kind of separate yourself from all the other things that keep you busy in the world. So it's a time thing, and it's hard to crank out a show, even one show a week. I'm amazed that when we started this, we were doing two shows a week, but it's just getting tougher to do all these shows with everything else I'm juggling right now. So that's the practical reason. It's time, in the sense that I don't have as much free time as I wish I did. And because of that, I'm not able to get the guests that I'm looking for. I'm not able to add the bells and whistles that I feel that this show needs to bring it up to another level. And, when you create something, you try to evolve it, you try to make it bigger and better as it goes along. And the funny thing is, and this leads into the bigger reason why I've decided to close the circuit here, is that, we finished up with 1980 Tops about 3 months ago. And we did a listener survey. We said, what direction do you want the show to go in? And we took all the answers and we said, okay, we're going to, just go all over the map. We'll just randomly pull a card and talk about the player and the set. And, we'll mix in some, interesting shows in between, like memorabilia or whatever. And seemed like to be a good idea. But then we did several of these shows, and the number of listeners decreased quite noticeably. And I don't do the show just to see how many people are listening. This isn't a thing like with radio where you have Nielsen ratings, formerly called Arbitron ratings. You may have heard of them, or the Nielsen ratings in TV. I'm not doing this just to try to, pump up an audience. But, if the numbers dip, then there's a reason behind it. And at first I thought maybe it was a technical reason. I thought, maybe one of the platforms that I do this show on, like, iHeartRadio or iTunes or whatever, maybe when somebody clicks on the link to listen, it doesn't ping back to Audio Boom, where the show is based out of. So I thought, that might be the reason. And I checked with Audio Boom. I said, hey, are you aware of any, other platforms not pinging back when somebody listens? And they said no. So, You know, I saw the numbers dip, and then it dawned on me, you know what? You really did close the circuit here. And think about it. If you include the original shows, you know, the first idea behind the program, which was to go through the big monster box and start with 1981 Fleer and go through my collection, which was primarily junk wax era baseball cards through 1993 tops. And then we had the first listener survey where everybody said, go back to the 50s and work your way up through the 70s. So before we had the second survey, we basically covered every set, or most every set. You know, there were a few that I didn't collect, 55, 56 tops, but also, you know, a couple of the sets from the 1993 era that I just didn't get my hands on for one reason or another. So with those exceptions, we basically have a report on every baseball card set released from 1954 through 1993. So that right there is 40 years of baseball card history wrapped up in various podcast, over 100 or almost over 100 podcasts at that point in time. And it dawned on me, you know, we closed the circuit. We've provided an interesting look at every set, or most every set again, and some interesting players along the way. And I think once we closed the circuit, some people just kind of fell off. They stopped listening because, why do I need to hear about 81 Fleer again? Or why do I need to hear about 74 Tops again? And it just kind of scaled back there. So, I kind of sat back and looked at it, and I went, you know, if we're losing interest just because we've perceived to have closed the circuit here on the information on these sets, and, you know, for the most part, these players, even though there's a lot of interesting stories with players that we pull, then it's kind of plateaued. This is about as good as it's going to get. And I'm a big believer, and this is something that you see in broadcasting and show business. You see shows that just, you know, they're kept on just for the sake of being kept on. Like, you know, The Office. Anybody who's watched the American version of The Office with Steve Carell and Rainn Wilson and that cast that warmed our hearts with their insanity in the Dunder Mifflin paper sales office in Scranton, Pennsylvania. We all know once Jim and Pam got married, I mean, the show was over, but it just kept going for years and years and years. And, you know, Steve Carell leaves and, you know, it's still going. It got old. It ran its course and tried to keep going. So in terms of the Wax Ecstatic podcast, I don't want it to go that way. It's pretty good right now. It's adequate. I wish it could be better. I don't have the time to make it as good as I want it to be, or as good as it could be, I guess. And I don't want to keep it going just for the sake of keeping it going. So what we leave behind, as this is episode number, 103, what we leave behind is more than 100 episodes of a history of baseball cards, ranging from, you know, 1954, okay, we skip a couple years, 1957 through 1993, we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the best part is that all of these shows are still available for listening via our archive, and that is on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Blueberry. And we also will keep the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed open. So it's not like we're completely closing up shop. It's time to end this particular chapter of Wax Ecstatic. Now, what does that mean in the future, you may be wondering? Well, I don't know. There, that's my answer. That's what I got for you. No, seriously, I don't know. We'll see, because what I can promise you is I'm not getting out of the hobby. Once I got back in, I was sucked back in. And, even though I'm not buying cards at a pace that I was when I was a teenager, you know, I still occasionally buy them and I still collate them and collect them and, you know, show them off, be it in a cardboard box or a binder full of those plastic pages. So I'm not getting out of the hobby. I'm still going to mentor my son in, you know, collecting. That's another reason why I don't have as much free time. I'm mentoring my son and actually playing baseball, coaching his little league team. So, you know, it's just one of those things that kind of take precedence over this. But, you know, again, the podcast, the archive will be there. The Twitter feed will be there. The tip jar will still be there. You know, again, I've never done this just for money, but yeah, if you listen to some of these old episodes and you want to continue the operations of it, because in order to keep the archive up, there is a production cost to that. The tip jars are still there if you want to make a donation at any time. PayPal.me/WaxExstatic or Venmo.com/WaxExstatic. But as for anything beyond this, we'll see. You never know when I may just pop up and throw a podcast out there. You never know. You never know when I may just do a pack auction. I don't know. You never know when something bigger and better does come out. You know, this idea of what the podcast could be. You know, there may be a Wax Ecstatic 2.0. I have no idea. We'll see. But in the meantime, enjoy this show, which we will get back to normal programming in a moment. Enjoy the archive that we have. It is, I do have to pat myself on the back a little bit here. It is a pretty good collection of card conversation. And the fact that we went through, you know, going from 1954 to 1993, we have essentially 40 years of baseball card history, including in-depth analysis of the Topps, Fleer, and Donruss cards of the 80s, followed by Bowman, Upper Deck, Score, later added on Fleer Ultra, Stadium Club, you name it. It's a pretty good collection about collections. So even though new episodes of Wax Ecstatic won't be coming out certainly anytime soon, I still encourage you to tell friends about the podcast, tell them about the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, because it is a good educational resource. And if anything, it allows you, the listener, the collector, to go back and listen to some of the podcasts about the cards that you collected, and you get to take that second or third look at some of your favorite or not so favorite sets. And as you'll discover, there are some cards that you really, really liked that you'll always remember. And there are some cards that, you know, at first you didn't really care for them, but when you take a second look, you go, you know, that's not so bad, or I didn't know this about this particular set. And there, of course, are great stories about the players, too. And I highly recommend, for those who are looking for more stories about the players, you know, look into the Society of American Baseball Research, or SABRE. The SABRE Project assigns feature stories to their writers, and some of those stories contain some really, really interesting, you know, background information that you may not have known about certain players. There's always Wikipedia, and Wikipedia is in a much better position now than it was, say, 10 or 12 years ago when it started, and people would just throw anything up there and people would believe it. There are a lot of verifiable resources of information that set up a Wikipedia page now, so that's always good. And my top reference is books, you know, especially some of the better known players. You're going to find books about them, or at least books about the teams. So go to your local library, check out books about your favorite ball players. Most libraries have used bookstores within them, and you can get books for a dollar, you know, hardcover books for a dollar. I did a lot of my summer reading collecting books from the downtown Tampa Public Library. I paid a grand total of, I think it was $11.50 for 8 or 9 books, and really got some great stories and, you know, some interesting stories, different perspectives. You know, I got some from, you know, Billy Martin, and, you know, I got a great story about the 66 World Series between the Dodgers and Orioles. And, you know, some, I wouldn't put them in the great category, but some interesting stories from, you know, people like Al Michaels, but also Jimmy Pearsall, the late Jimmy Pearsall, Jay Johnstone. You know, there were some interesting stories that I was able to get at a cheap price at a used bookstore within the library. And check out your local used bookstore if you're lucky enough to have one in your town. Amazon, of course, sells used books. So if there's a favorite player of yours or a favorite team, chances are there are several books written about them. And I would encourage you to read those and, you know, enlighten yourself with some of the interesting stories behind some of the players and teams that make the sport of baseball interesting, but also the hobby of collecting baseball cards even more interesting. And finally, before we talk about card number 77 from the 1980 top set here, my thanks to everybody who did listen to this, even though I am ending this. And like I said, like the TV shows that run too long, I don't want that to happen. I don't want this show to keep going on just for the sake of going on. I feel that we are leaving on top. And that's a good place to leave. When you can look at everything and go, we've done really well. This is as good as it's going to get in its current format. Let's stop. And, you know, we have over 100 episodes of this show. Like I said, 40 years of baseball card history. And I couldn't do it without you. So in one sense, I know I feel like I'm shortchanging you by going, all right, all done, turn the lights out. But in the other sense, it wouldn't have gotten this far. I wouldn't have had as much fun doing this if it weren't for you. And I always go back to that first episode where I joked, oh, this will die in about 5 weeks like every other side project I've done. Well, it didn't. It lasted over 100 episodes. That's over a year, I believe about a year and 4 months of doing this. You know, again, at the frantic pace in the beginning with 2 episodes a week. And then we scaled it back to 1 episode. That's pretty much what we've been doing for the last 8 or 9 months. So there you go. I would not have enjoyed talking to myself merely for myself for 100 plus episodes for over a year of entertainment. So I thank you. And I thank all the people who have, you know, commented on Wax and Gum Stains, all the support that you've given me on the show. For those who have traded cards with me, you know, there are several of you who've done that, who've reached out through Wax and Gum Stains, DMing me. I appreciate that. And, you know, I thank you very much for doing that. So, you know, again, to keep the connection between me and you going, while we're not doing it with a podcast, we'll do it with the archived shows. We'll do it with the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. And I will continue to check the Twitter feed, comment on it, and, you know, go ahead and, you know, keep that alive and well. So, you know, again, thank you. There's no way that this show would have had anywhere near the success it did if it wasn't for you and your interest in the hobby and the great sport of baseball. All right, with that said, let's take a look at our final card here. And again, this is honestly not a random pull. This is one that I purposely selected from the 1980 top set, card number 77, Dave Steeb. It is Dave Steeb's rookie card, and it is one of the few cards that features Steeb without his legendary mustache. The only other card that didn't have the Dave Steeb mustache was the 1981 Donruss card. And that's because, as we discussed, you know, when Fleer and Donruss started in 1981, they were often dealing with outdated photographs, pictures that were 2 or 3 years old, or in the case of 81 Donruss, even Keith Olbermann former ESPN sports anchor, now a commentator with MSNBC, or actually he's not with MSNBC anymore, but he's a political commentator. You know, he actually sold, I think it was 15 photographs that he took as a teenager. He sold those to Donruss. So, Donruss was really struggling with the photography collection in the early days. So the picture of Dave Steeb, sans mustache, it was taken in Comiskey Park, and he's wearing the old powder blue Blue Jay uniform. I'm sure that picture was actually taken in like 1979 when he started. And that's one of the few cards that does not feature the legendary Dave Steeb mustache. Now, what's also interesting is we're talking about facial hair here. If you look at the 84 Topps Dave Steeb, that is the rare card where he has the full beard going. So fortunately, he got rid of the lumberjack look and went with the mustache look for a very, very, very long time. But this is a rarity because it shows, again, the unmustachioed and also not much of a mullet Dave Steeb on the mound at Exhibition Stadium, starting what would turn out to be one hell of a career. And we'll talk about that in a moment. And my run-in with Dave Steeb, and I mean that in a good way, a great memory and moment from my time when I was a little younger. So I'll share that in a little bit, but very briefly, 1980 Topps. Dave Steeb is one of three key rookie cards in the set. Another one, Rick Sutcliffe, pretty successful pitcher throughout the 1980s, primarily with the Chicago Cubs. And the other one, a guy you may have heard of, Ricky Henderson. Yes, that's kind of the big card in the 1980 top set. Now, you have a lot of second and third year cards for many of the great stars of the 1980s, names I've mentioned before, like Dale Murphy and Jack Morris and Paul Molitor. And you've got some later career cards, guys like George Brett and Robin Yount and Mike Schmidt, and all those legends that have carried over from the 1960s. So you've got Nolan Ryan, you've got Steve Carlton, you've got Pete Rose, you've got Tom Seaver was still playing then, Phil Niekro. So many great players from the 60s, a lot of them from the 70s, but it's that Ricky Henderson card that keeps the 1980 top set alive and kicking. And why is that? Because the 1980 top set was not the best set. And again, this is just my opinion on the design. I've often called it the overweight or the pregnant version of 74 Topps, where you have the white frame, you have the inner frame, and then you have the two flags, one on top, one on bottom. But while 1974 Topps pulled it off in a nice, clean fashion, 80 Topps just gets a little sloppy with it. You know, the flags are kind of drifting in their corners. It kind of looks more like a beauty contestant sash than flags, and it just looks kind of bloated. And that's kind of the word that I describe. If you took 1974 Topps, added 15 pounds and gave it a large t-shirt, that's kind of the look that 1980 Topps has here. Now, even though I say that, and the design leaves a lot to be desired. And this is also, again, if you look at it with context, it's part of a little bit of a dry spell that Topps had in the late 70s and stretching into the early 80s. 1979 through 1982 were not the best times for Topps, just in terms of design. It was the first time that they had to deal with a competition with Fleer and Donruss coming around in 1981. And by the way, if you haven't listened to my previous podcast on 1980 Topps, and it featured Len Barker of the Cleveland Indians, I go into much greater detail about the history of Topps having their monopoly end, how a lawsuit by the Fleer Company back in the mid-70s got the ball rolling. So I encourage you to listen to that. Again, that's 1980 Topps with Len Barker. So I won't go into the whole history again of the way the industry was going in 1980. But suffice to say, in 1980, Topps knew its time was up. Kind of mailed in this design, in my opinion. And very quickly, they found themselves going up against competition in Fleer and Donruss. However, this was the last time that you did not see the Topps logo on the front of the card. The 1979 set is just blasted for having the Topps logo up there, because even in 79, Topps knew, okay, our time is going to be up as a monopoly. Well, 1980, they didn't put the logo on there. It was in July of 1980 that Fleer won its lawsuit, and Topps was going to have to face competition the following season. So this is the last chance at a truly clean front of a card where Topps doesn't have its logo on it. Now, it has its sash, it has the player name up top, and it has the faux autograph, which is something that Topps would rely on throughout much of the mid-70s. They brought it back in 1980. They would get away with from it in 81, but bring it back in 82. And then that was the last time, I believe, that you saw the faux autograph on the front of the cards. But it still looks nice and clean in the overall sense. A lot of space devoted to pictures. And while you could call this an action shot, not the best in terms of action shots, but better than just a staged photograph here is Steve in front of a pretty full crowd at Exhibition Stadium here, winding up for, I'm sure, one of his backdoor sliders here. As a, you would have no idea that the career that would unfold would be a pretty good one throughout the decade of the 1980s. 1980 Topps is a 726 card set. Again, the Rickey Henderson card is the one that anchors it. And while the front is not very appealing, the back is very interesting. As we flip the card over here, you have the card number in a home plate shaped box in the upper left hand corner. Also, the horizontal presentation of information here, player position, name, and team across the top. You've got the cartoon that was legendary in Topps cards at this time on the left side, all the information on the right side, and if space permitted, then you would have a little interesting tidbit or trivial information about the player. And of course, because Steve was just starting his career here, you know, they're stretching a little bit, you know, four hits to his first victory against the Brewers, a complete game with four strikeouts and three walks. They don't even mention the opponent in a 7-1 Blue Jay victory, and then, you know, winning his last three consecutive starts at Syracuse during the 1979 season. So they're still touching on some minor league notes here. And then at the bottom, the personal information, you know, the height, weight, birth, town, all that information kind of squeezed into this little bar at the bottom of the card. Now, one thing that I did like about 1980 Topps was the color selection on the back. We've discussed numerous times about how green was the dominant color throughout the 1970s and into the early 1980s. Now, our last podcast on 78 Topps, I mentioned how the orange and blue color coordination was very unique but stood out. Well, in 1980, they went with blue and black, and I've always thought this stood out, and I thought it looked good, even on the gray cardstock. It has this kind of a cool feeling to it. As long as the ink didn't smudge, then you had a pretty easy experience of reading the information on the back of these cards. But while orange was a rarity, as I mentioned before, it was used in 1964, 72, 78, and then 88. Well, 83 a little bit, and then, you know, more predominantly in 88. Blue was a color that was not used that much at all, at least as a dominant color, on the back of Topps cards. In fact, you have to go all the way back to 1965 when blue was the dominant color on the back of the card. And then after 1980, blue became more of a dominant color in the later part of the decade. So 1984, also 1987, it was kind of mixed with blue and gold, very similar to the 1970 design. And then that was pretty much it. Blue was not a big color selection for Topps. I'm not sure why. Maybe they had some kind of you know, consumer information that said that blue was not appealing, or what the likely cause was is that blue ink was more expensive than green ink. They couldn't buy it in bulk, I guess. But for whatever reason, blue was not a predominant color on the backs of Topps cards for many, many years. So when it does show up it's always neat. I've always liked it. You know, the 84 top specs are very nice. 65 top specs are cool. I've always liked the 1965 Topps car. So even though the front is not extremely exciting, the back, I think, kind of makes up for it. And overall, you get a good but not great set. That's not to say this is a terrible set. In fact, I know a lot of listeners love this set because, much like 78 Topps, 1980, you're only 2 years removed from 1978. Chances are, if you're around my age or slightly older, you know, you're in your mid-40s, let's just put it that way, this was right in your wheelhouse. You know, if you're 44, 45 years old right now, when you started collecting around the age of 7 or 8, 1980, that's when it was happening. And these were the cards that you were collecting. And you probably still have a bunch in a box somewhere if your mom didn't throw them out or you didn't abuse them as a kid and put them in your bike spokes. But, you know, 1980 Topps is in your wheelhouse. So despite whatever flaws there may be, you still love the set. And that's perfectly fine. And I've said before, you know, 89 Topps was my first top set or my first baseball card set that I collected from. And yeah, there's flaws in 89 Topps. It's right in the heart of the junk wax era. But I'll always have a special connection to 89 Topps because that was the first pack that I bought. So if 1980 Topps was the first set that you collected, you're not too concerned about the beauty contestant sash look or if the ink smudges or if the card's slightly off center. This is your baby. This was the first set that you collected. And fortunately for you, 1980 Topps is still relatively accessible out there. It is part of an era of cards from 1976 to 1981. Which recently has been marked up quite a bit. It is, I wouldn't call it a rare set to find wax packs or boxes of, but it's certainly not in big production like some of the cards from the mid to late 80s. So 1980 Topps is a set that is still available. It will cost you a little bit more. And as collectors continue to chase the Ricky Henderson rookie card, but also second and third year cards of some of the players who came out as rookies in the late 70s and became stars in the 1980s. It is still very, very appreciated by collectors. You can still get wax packs for decent price. I still see them for, you know, around $8 to $10 a piece. And I've seen wax boxes as well. If you're able to afford a few hundred dollars to fork over for that, then be my guest. Cello packs and rack packs are also available at fairly decent prices. I see the cello packs going for around $20, $25. Rack packs about the same price. As always, though, just be very careful when buying vintage, unopened, quote-unquote unopened wax products or cello or rack packs, as unfortunately hobby people have bought old wrappers and they will stuff them with common cards and seal them and sell them as unopened, and that's where you can get burned. So just be very careful. Make sure you're buying from a reputable dealer and look for the telltale signs of a pack being monkeyed with. One, is the wrapper out of, you know, skew? Are the edges not sharp? But also, if it's on eBay and if it's selling for $1.75, chances are it's not a truly new unopened pack. So always keep that in mind. But this also falls into the category of, as much as I'm not crazy about the set, if you get a chance to buy a lot of them at a card store, card show, somebody's just trying to get rid of their collection at a garage sale, by all means, do it. Again, this is one of those sets that you can get the cards for maybe 10 cents a piece, and you can end up walking away with practically an entire set of cards for probably $20 or $30. Even some of the semi-star cards, you know, as long as it's not Ricky Henderson, you can essentially buy this whole set secondhand from somebody for under $50. And I'm all about getting hands on vintage sets because this is the last of the, you know, pre-junk wax era times. This is the last of the Topps monopoly, and this was the last time that they could just float out any old design and do things their way, because they had to face Fleer and Donruss, and ultimately down the line, Score and Upper Deck and, you know, all the premium style cards that came out in the early 90s. So this was the last of the monopoly, the last of a 25-year run for Topps. And, you know, we're fortunate that a set that is 37 years old is still available in pretty good quantities and quality as well. So keep an eye out for that. Now, as for Dave Steeb, it's so funny, and I didn't notice this until I pulled the card and did the show. His card number 77, and if you've listened to this podcast, you know I have so many connections to the number 77. I was born in 1977. The Toronto Blue Jays, my favorite team as a kid, they were born in 1977. And I just find it funny that arguably the greatest pitcher in Toronto Blue Jays history shares the number of the team's first season. I find that very, very neat. It might be a coincidence. Maybe Topps knew something that we didn't know, but there you go. And, you know, Dave Steeb, I don't think outside of Toronto or Canada, rather, gets the credit that he deserves. Dave Steeb won the second most number of games in the 1980s behind Jack Morris. And you know how I feel about Jack Morris and the Hall of Fame. He should be in Cooperstown. Dave Steeb should not be in Cooperstown. And I know recently he got all upset that he was removed from the ballot because he was not getting enough votes. And he was also, you know, he had just completed his 10th year on the ballot because he came back in a comeback attempt in 1998. But, you know, numbers-wise, he's not Hall of Fame worthy. He had a really good career, but not a Hall of Fame career. And as big of a fan of Dave Steeb and the Toronto Blue Jays as I was, I'm not foolish enough to go, this guy should be in Cooperstown. No, he really shouldn't. But what I will say is the Toronto Blue Jays should retire the number 37. Dave Steeb is in the Blue Jay Ring of Honor. And a lot of stadiums and a lot of sports have this, where, you know, the facade of one of the decks shows the name and number of a particular player. And, you know, that's great that he's in the Ring of Honor. But there will never be a pitcher like Dave Steeb in Toronto ever again. And that's not to say the Blue Jays won't ever have good pitchers. They've got some good ones now. But Dave Steeb was one of a kind in so many ways. Not only the number of wins that he had in the 1980s, not only the number of near no-hitters that he had, he could have had four or five no-hitters in his career had they not been broken up with base hits in the ninth inning. And of course, Steeb finally got his no-hitter September 2nd, 1990 in Cleveland against the Indians. So, you know, here's a guy who could dominate and throw complete games. And again, that's a stat that's going to go out the window, you know, with how pitchers are used, especially after the World Series. You know, I've joked around that, you know, with how the World Series went between the Dodgers and the Astros this year, teams are going to start emulating the two-man rotation and 14-man bullpen. I mean, it is a copycat league. You know, once a team wins the World Series, everybody goes, well, how do we do that? So don't be surprised if you see that. So the complete game stat is just going to go the way of the dodo over the next 10 or 15 years. But, you know, Steeb could pitch complete games. He could, you know, tempt fate with no hitters. He could win games. And he won a ton of games with a team that during the first 3 or 4 years of his major league career was not very good. In fact, when he started in 1979, the Blue Jays were absolutely abysmal. You know, your first year as an expansion team, you put out a decent enough team. There's a wow factor of the team starting. But by year number two, you're starting to trade away these veterans for younger players. By year number three, you've traded away almost everybody from that first year team. You've got a lot of spare parts just holding the fort down because by then you're drafting high, you're getting top prospects, but they're still two or three years away. And that's where the Blue Jays were in 1979 when Steve came on board. So he was a pitcher for some pretty bad teams in 79, 80, 81, 82, but he still racked up wins. He was the most consistent player as the Blue Jays started bringing in younger talent, and they weren't pitchers too. You know, I mean, they had some half decent pitchers, but the pitchers that the Blue Jays were known for in the 80s, guys like Jimmy Key and later David Wells and Todd Stottlemyre, you know, that was 10 years later. In the early 80s, the best prospects that they had coming up were guys like George Bell and Lloyd Mosby and Willie Upshaw and Alfredo Griffin. And then later in the decade, you got your Kelly Grubers and, you know, Fred McGriff, who was actually a New York Yankees draft pick. Then you had Jesse Barfield, you know, all these other guys started coming around in the mid to late 80s. So Steve was really the first star of the Toronto Blue Jays in the sense of the first star who was drafted, brought up through the system, and who had a major league career. Now, the amazing story about Steve is that he shouldn't have even been a pitcher, believe it or not. He was born in Santa Ana, California in 1957, went to college at Southern Illinois University. So in 1976, the Blue Jays, the franchise has been awarded. They've got scouts out looking around for cornerstone players. And it turns out Bobby Maddock, who would, you know, not only be a manager for the Blue Jays, but would also be a longtime executive for the team. He goes out to scout the skinny kid who is playing at Southern Illinois. And at the time, he is an outfielder. And they're scouting him in 1976, like I said, 77. And they go out to watch him, and he's not really impressing them. Not really good at the bat. He's got a decent arm. He's a good defender, but, you know, there's not a whole lot to this skinny kid from California who's, for whatever reason, playing at Southern Illinois in Carbondale, Illinois. But as fate would have it, at the game that Maddock is scouting him at, Steve takes the mound. And all of a sudden, he wows the Blue Jays scouts in his proficiency as a pitcher. So they're like, hey, you know, this guy does have something else other than, you know, the outfield work. So in 1978, they draft him in the fifth round. And, you know, at first he's doing some outfield work in the minor leagues in Dunedin. But again, they see the writing on the wall very quickly. Okay, this guy's not going to make it as an outfielder. Let's put him on the mound. And as a pitcher, he works his way up through the Blue Jays system very quickly. You know, he was drafted in 1978. He pitches four games with Dunedin, has a 2.08 earned run average and a 2-0 record. So his next season in 1979, he splits the season between Dunedin and Syracuse and Toronto. 8 games in Dunedin, 7 games in Syracuse, pretty good win-loss record. Dunedin's earned run average, not so great, but he had a good strikeout-to-walk ratio. He still had that slider, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And he very quickly gets fast-tracked to the major leagues to where he made his major league debut in Oakland in the summer of 1979. And as this Topps card mentioned, would pick up his first victory in July of that year against Milwaukee. So Dave Steeb goes from unimpressive outfielder to major league starter in the time span of just about 2 years, which is pretty darn impressive. Well, what was really impressive about his repertoire was that backdoor slider, a slider that former Blue Jays manager Jimmy Williams once told me was what he called the pucker pitch. I looked at him. I said, pucker pitch. He says, yep. Every time he threw that thing inside, it would just drop down like a rock. And the batter would stand up, you know, all erect, you know, trying to straighten up to sell it to the umpire that it was a ball. And he would always get rung up. And every time that batter, you know, straightened up, he said, his butthole puckered up. I just went, all right. So the pucker pitch, if you will, is the pitch that made Dave Steeb famous. He had a pretty good velocity on his fastball, had a very good curveball as well. But his out pitch was that slider. And if you go on YouTube and you just watch Dave Steeb's highlights, that slider was flat out nasty. And it got him a long, long career in Major League Baseball. So he becomes a pitcher with the Blue Jays throughout his minor league experience, makes the All-Star game in 1980 as well as 1981, actually started the All-Star game in 1983. In fact, started back-to-back All-Star games in 83 and 84, something that hadn't been done until this year, having a starter start the All-Star game in back-to-back seasons. He also led the American League in earned run average in 1985 and owns pretty much every pitching record for the Toronto Blue Jays for all of his many years of service. Now, come the early 1990s, he started experiencing some shoulder problems, and he wound up on the disabled list more often than not in 1992. In fact, the 1992 season, a little bittersweet, because that, of course, is the year that the Blue Jays finally won the World Series after so much promise. But Steve, because of all the injuries that he had, appeared in just 21 games, had a 4-6 record, and a 5.04 earned run average. Now, in 91, that was the first year that he was really experiencing arm problems. He only appeared in 9 games that season. So it was a little bit of a triumphant comeback in 92 that he was able to work his way into the rotation a lot more. But of those 21 games, only 14 were starts. He was appearing as a reliever a lot by then. And by the age of 34, you know, his body was just starting to betray him. So in 1992, it's bittersweet because Steeb finally wins that World Series with Toronto. If you look at the highlights of the Blue Jays winning the World Series in Atlanta, Fulton County Stadium, you know, the visitors' dugout was on the third base side. And, you know, the ground ball gets fielded over to Joe Carter, who is playing first base, and Carter's jumping up and down. The crowd that comes out of the Blue Jay dugout, Dave Steeb was one of the first guys out there. Yeah, he just finally, after all these years of playing for at first a bad team and then a team that was good but had so many expectations, finally they win. But at the end of the 1992 season, he is done with the Blue Jays. Yes, the end of an era. I couldn't believe it when they finally you know, cut ties with him. It was very sad, to be honest with you. But he would sign as a free agent with the Chicago White Sox in December of 1992. And I remember getting his 93 Upper Deck card. Upper Deck was a lot better with getting photographs of players in spring training and pushing them out in their Series 2 sets in 1993. I remember getting that 93 Upper Deck card, and there's Dave Steeb in a Chicago White Sox jersey. It was the strangest thing seeing that happen. His time with Chicago, unfortunately, was short, appearing in just 4 games, starting all 4 games, but with a 1-3 record, 6.04 earned run average, and the White Sox would release him in May of 1993. He would sign on with Kansas City as a free agent, but never made it to the major leagues, was really struggling with the minor leagues, and finally basically called it quits in the summer of 1993. Or did he? No, he actually came out of retirement in 1998. The Blue Jays were bad once again, and Steve felt, rejuvenated, felt like he could give it one more try. He wasn't the only player who was trying comebacks back then, although he was one of the few who was 40 years old and trying to make a comeback in the major leagues. So he signs with the Blue Jays, who, let's be honest, you know, this is a little bit of a publicity stunt as well. And he actually makes his way back to the big leagues. He appears in 19 games in the 98 season, starts three of them, has a 1-2 record and a 4.83 earned run average, so nothing really exciting there. Is still able to get the ball over the plate with 27 strikeouts, 17 walks. But for a guy who was idle for almost 5 years, Steve actually made a pretty good comeback here. And it's actually well remembered by the Toronto fans because he was the greatest pitcher, certainly of the 1980s, and again, arguably of the Blue Jays franchise. And, you know, the fact that he was able to come in off the sidelines after a 5-year layover and actually pitch somewhat productively, especially during the steroid home run era of baseball. A lot of fans gave him a lot of props for that. So he would become a free agent in 1998 after the 98 season and officially retire. Now, Steve, since then, has calmed down a little bit. He was known as a, to put it nicely, fierce competitor. I'll put it another way, high strung, bit of a red ass. He could get on his fellow players. You know, if somebody made an error in the field, he would yell at them or glare at them. If he gave up a home run, he would stomp up and down on the mound. He could sometimes act like a spoiled brat, to be honest with you. But that's just how fierce of a competitor he was, where if something went wrong, even if it was out of his control, he just couldn't control himself. So he was very high strung as a player, certainly mellowed out during his comeback when he was 40 years old, and now at the age of 60, much more mellower than when he was a major league pitcher. He is now a construction contractor. He actually has helped design and build several subdivisions in Reno, Nevada, where he lives now. And he is still a guitar player. That's his hobby. He picked up guitar playing when he was in his 20s, and he actually had a little house band throughout the 1980s. And he wrote a book, too, called Someday I'll Be Perfect, which, of course, is a play on, you know, all those near no-hitters. It was released in, I want to say, 1986, maybe. You know, he wasn't kind to some of his former teammates. I'll credit that to youth. But, you know, we're all cocky when we're younger. But Dave Steve was certainly no exception there. So, you know, some of the habits from the old days, like playing guitar in his spare time, still does it. Some of the other habits, like ripping teammates and just being a red ass, apparently that has dialed down just a little bit. But he is, like I said, still active, you know, creating communities in Reno, Nevada, and appearing at the odd baseball card show every now and then. In fact, he was a guest of the Vancouver Canadiens minor league team a few years ago. And I was able to find an article about that, and that's where he was updating people on what he was doing nowadays. Now, I have my own story about Dave Steeb. Like I said, he was my favorite Blue Jay, and he was my favorite Blue Jay for honestly, absolutely no good reason. It's kind of like why I followed the Blue Jays. I was living in Florida. My favorite team was in Canada. I have no idea why I picked the Blue Jays. I honestly have no clue. But I did, and I picked them at the right time in the late 80s. I mean, they went on to do some great things just a few years later. But Dave Steeb, there was just something about him, and I think it's the underappreciated value of him that attracted me to say, that's the player that I want to, you know, get behind. And I've always had that, and maybe there's a deeper psychological thing here about the underappreciation. I've always had that connection to, you know, the George Harrisons of the world. Everyone loved John and Paul of the Beatles, but George Harrison never got the due that he should have during the Beatles' glory days in the 60s. But of all of the people, you know, of all the members of the Beatles who grew into something great, you know, yeah, John Lennon and Paul McCartney were very good at what they did. And you know, Ringo Starr had his moments in the sunlight too. But George Harrison was, I mean, arguably one of the greatest guitar players in the classic rock era. So, you know, I always had this affinity for the George Harrisons, the Shemp Howards, Shemp Howard of the Three Stooges, you know, those types of people who don't get the respect that they're due when they're at their best. And it's often in retrospect, people go, oh, yeah, that guy was pretty good at what he did. Dave Steeb is the epitome of that. And like I said, he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. But there's nobody is ever going to wear the number 37 with the Toronto Blue Jays like Dave Steeb did. And as I said, they've got him on the, you know, the Ring of Honor, and that's nice. But you need to really honor this guy. Because every time I see a Blue Jay, and it's typically a pitcher, but every time I see a Blue Jay wearing the number 37, I do a double take. It's just like, that's not right. I mean, this was your best, most consistent player for over 10 years, and you still don't honor him. I mean, what does it take to retire a number? You know, with Roberto Alomar's number retired, Blue Jays players, if you keep the number zero open and you retire the number 37, they still have 98 options. They can find something to wear. So I'm still mystified by that, but equally mystified as to why I like Dave Steeb, but I did. And I started collecting all of his cards. And that kind of became a side project when I was younger. And of course, back then it was a lot easier to do because when I started, you only had, you had six card companies. But then things got a little out of control with all the premium cards in the early 90s, so it was a lot harder to track them down. But I had to go back and find the previous year's cards. And this was something I did, I worked really hard on, I want to say in like 1990. So throughout the 1990 season, I'm collecting all these old cards, be it through packs or I would go to card shows. And I'll never forget the last card that I needed to complete the set before, you know, the next season came around and I had a whole new collection of cards to get. The last card I had to get was 84 Tops. And I remember finding it at a card shop in, I think, Treasure Island, Florida. And I was so glad that I could finally, I mean, it was the most elusive card in 84 Topps card, but I found it. But, I'll always remember this 1980 Topps card because I bought it at a flea market. And, I spent like $4 on it, which, you know, when you're 12 or 13 years old, it's kind of a big amount of money back in 1990 to buy a card. But I found it at a flea market. And that's why when you look at this card, yeah, it's a little off center and the corners are a little soft, but you know, it's the first card. And I was so glad that I could track that card down. And I always remember where I got it and how I got it. But to wrap up the Dave Steeb thoughts, I actually met him in person in 1991. It was during spring training and it was my first spring training game that I had gone to. My younger brother and a friend of ours, a family friend of ours named Ray Taylor, who was an assistant scoutmaster in my Boy Scout troop, he was a big baseball fan. He collected baseball cards. And somehow, one way or the other, we were able to convince my parents, let's buy some tickets to a Toronto Blue Jays spring training game. And let's see if we can get Mr. Taylor to take us to the ballpark. I don't know why my parents couldn't, but Mr. Taylor was all cool about that. He says, oh yeah, let's go to a baseball game. So we get the tickets and they were like $6 a piece. goes to show you how long ago this was. I bought spring training tickets for the Bradenton Pirates or the Pittsburgh Pirates. They play in Bradenton. And I think I spent $22. Yeah, so times have changed. But we get the tickets, and I bring my folder of cards with me because the stadium in Dunedin, and it still has this, by the way, on the third base side, there's kind of this dugout between the third base dugout and the clubhouse. Now, the Blue Jays clubhouse back then was on the third base side, and they had the third base dugout. And the clubhouse didn't have a tunnel to the dugout like a major league stadium does. The players would have to walk from the clubhouse through this walkway past this little fan dugout and then out onto the field. So I'm standing there, and Kelly Gruber, who was their third baseman at the time, comes over and he's signing autographs. So I get a card and a ball signed by him. And while I'm waiting for more players to come by, this guy comes up to me and he says, and he's on the other side of the fence. He's on the player side of the fence. He says, "Hey kid, how old are you?" I said, "I'm 13. He says, "13?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Would you like to be a bat boy today?" And I was just stunned. And I'll never forget my answer. I said, "Yeah, let me check." Let me check. You know, what I really meant to say was, "Yeah, let me put my cards down with my, you know, adult supervisor." So I go back, my brother and I go back to Mr. Taylor, and I hand him my cards. I said, "They're going to make me a bat boy." And he says, "What?" I said, "Yeah, they're going to make me a bat boy." So I go back and I'm in the clubhouse and they, you know, give me a full uniform. And there's a picture of me in that uniform. If you look at episode one, that's the picture of me that day Mr. Taylor took of me. And to make a long story short, they basically assigned me duty in the Chicago White Sox dugout. They were on the other side of the dugout or the other side of the field. And, you know, basically I was a terrible bat boy. I had no idea what I was doing. And I was just kind of lost in the moment. You know, I didn't help the Chicago White Sox out at all. They had a stack of bats rolling around at one end of the dugout because I didn't know where to put them. You know, Carlton Fisk was just an ass to me. Corey Snyder nearly took my head off with an on-deck swing. The Blue Jays management had fun with me. They played a prank on me. You know, it's all stories that are detailed in a written article, which I'm going to post on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed so you can get the full story there. But one of my favorite moments of that day was Dave Steeb was pitching, and he had come off a pretty solid 1990 season. The sky was the limit in 1991. Who knew that he would suffer so many injuries and the beginning of the end of his career would start that season. But that day against the White Sox, he was masterful. I forget what the final score was, but I know the Blue Jays won. I know Steve got credit for the victory. I know he pitched like three innings, did very well, baffled a White Sox team that had some pretty good talent on it, by the way. And after the game, I go into the locker room, and the guy who picked me out of the crowd says, you know, "Hey, good job. Thanks for doing it. You know, here's a hat and here's a bat." And I was basically paid with a fitted Blue Jays hat, which I still have. It doesn't fit anymore, obviously, but I still have it. And the bat was a game used broken Joe Carter bat, which I still have. And it was so cool. I'm like, wow, not only did I get to be a bat boy and be a Blue Jay for a day, but I've got a hat, I've got a bat. Let me see if I can get one more autograph. And I asked the guy, I said, "Excuse me, can I meet Dave Steeb?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure. Let me see where he is." So, you know, I guess Steeb was in the shower or something. So I'm just sitting in this locker stall just waiting. And he, you know, he comes out and he's dressed, by the way. He comes out and he's cursing up a storm. I mean, just F this, F that. And let me tell you, you know, you're 13 years old, you're using the same words, but when you hear it from somebody that you admire, you know, somebody you look up to, it's kind of jarring. It's just like, oh, Dave Steeb said the F word. So he comes over and he sits down in his locker stall and I come up to him. I say, "Hi, Mr. Steeb." I said, "Great game today." He said, "Oh, thank you." I said, "Can I get a couple of autographs?" He said, "Sure." And I gave him, I had an 88 Topps card and a 91 Donruss Diamond Kings card fresh off the presses. You know, this is like a month after I got the card. So he signs them. And I told him, I said, "You know, I'm collecting every card that you've had." He says, "Oh, that's really cool." And he signed the card, and I shook his hand. I said, thank you very much. And then I was on my own. I couldn't find the exit to the clubhouse, so I eventually found my way out and, you know, got with my brother and Mr. Taylor and went home. And I remember playing with baseball cards that night and falling asleep on my bedroom floor with a stack of baseball cards. And it's a day that I'll never forget. It's happened, 27, coming up on 27 years ago. But that's also, it goes to show you what one small kind deed can do. And working in sports, which I still do, working in sports, it goes to show that even the little things that you do for a fan go a long, long, long way. And I will never forget that. Not only because I have to do it with my job today with the Tampa Bay Lightning, but I experienced it myself as a kid with that great moment with the Toronto Blue Jays. So that was the day. It was in March of 1991. I met my favorite player. Got to watch him in action up close on the field as I was essentially an employee for the day for my favorite baseball team. And I got paid with a hat and a broken bat and a couple of signed baseball cards and a lot of great memories. And that is why I selected this Dave Steeb card number 77 from 1980 Tops, as our final featured card and player on the Wax Ecstatic podcast. So with that, I bid you adieu. I'm not going away. Again, I'm just doing this because I think the show has, in its current form, has run its course. And I don't want to keep it going just for the sake of keeping it going. It's just a time crunch, unfortunately. As much as I love talking baseball cards and baseball players, it's just, I'm getting squeezed right now, so I have to put it aside for that. But remember, the Wax Ecstatic Archive is out there. A lot of great shows, a lot of great conversation about some great and not so great baseball cards that were made over the years. They are available via Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Blueberry. And the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed is still open 24/7. And like I said, I'll be popping on there every now and then. You never know. So my appreciation to Dave Steeb and the Toronto Blue Jays for memories made almost 27 years ago that I'm able to share on this final podcast. And my appreciation to you for listening and for being a part of this. Who knows what is next for Wax Ecstatic? I have no idea. We'll see. But until then, be good. Be a good person. Collect all the cards that you want to collect. There's no wrong way of collecting. And enjoy the hobby. Enjoy the sport. And enjoy being a kid no matter what your age is. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for all your support with Wax Ecstatic. And until next time, whenever that is, whatever it involves, we'll see you then.